call-in user, is that? Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is June 11th, 2020. This is the second of six matters before this panel of the Court of Appeals this morning. I am Judge Louise Devery Bjorkman, and I am joined this morning on the panel by Judges Diane Bratfold and Jennifer Frisch. A couple of housekeeping matters before we go forward. First of all, I would ask the litigants, if you do not hear or see each other and the panel members, would you raise your hand right now? Okay, so I assume then everyone can hear and see. If that changes through the course of the morning, just raise your hand and we will have the host try to wrap you back in or address the issue. Another matter, it's important when you are not speaking that you put your microphone on mute. We find that we do get some feedback if everyone's microphones are active during the argument. I understand, again, that counsel for the respondents are splitting their time, and I understand you will see the timing, 15 minutes, and I understand that you will jump in after six or seven whenever you decide to make the change. So we will not be monitoring that for you. When the 15 minutes for response is up, your time is up, even if the second person arguing didn't get the full half time. So this is the matter of Joseph and Jennifer Roach versus Thomas Alinder and Gary Heitkamp Construction et al. Again, each side has 15 minutes to present the argument. It's important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent when you begin your argument. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Dennis Grand. I'm a lawyer in Minneapolis. I've practiced all over the state for over 40 years. I've come to understand the term getting hometowned. You all know about this case. This case has been going on for 15 years. It was filed in 2005. There have been dozens of hearings, a two-day court trial, a five-day jury trial, and three previous trips to the court, to this Court of Appeals. This is the fourth appeal. My client lives in the Twin Cities. He owns a cabin up on a lake near Detroit Lakes. His cabin and lot used to be the second lowest on the lake. His next door neighbor, the defendant, the Allenders, they were the lowest point on the lake until they raised their lot by 2+ feet and built a new cabin. That made my client the lowest on the lot and resulted in serious flooding of his cabin and lot continuously for the last 15 years. As I said, this action started in 2005, and three times the Court of Appeals has reversed the district court decision and sent the case back to get it right. The Roaches have won all three of the previous appeals. This last appeal, in the last appeal, and in the opinion, Judge Work wrote a scathing opinion rebuking the Becker County District Judge. In part, she said, while the district court concluded that the Allenders increased the pooling and ponding on the Roaches' property, reserved claims for liability and damages, if any. And if any were is in italics, both in the court, both in the district court's opinion and in the Court of Appeals opinion. This is error because the Roaches have been damaged. The Roaches were damaged as soon as the Allenders altered their property in a way that increased runoff to the Roaches' property.
Counsel, I'm going to stop you. I think we're all familiar, not as much as the litigants, obviously, with the lengthy history of this litigation. But in terms of the issues before this court, and given your limited time to make the argument, what do you consider your strongest argument in favor of reversal?
Here it is. A common misconception about remitter is that it always ends the case. Sometimes it does. Frequently it does. It's frequently results with no new trial, no appeal by the plaintiff. That is federal law. That's not Minnesota law, Wisconsin, California, and a host of other states. Under Minnesota law, plaintiff can't appeal the remitted issue. That's the $300,000 reduction in future damages. However, the issue is wholly unrelated to the remitted verdict, the $300,000, are issues that are separate and distinct from the remitted damages, and they can be appealed. And that's what we've appealed. We've appealed the reduction of the pre-verdict interest on the basis of equity. In other words, the court, we can appeal the interest even though we can't appeal the reduction in the damages. In this
But counsel, it seems to me the remittitor expressly extended to the issue of pre-verdict interest. I'm looking in at your addendum, page 5, and it looks like the conditional grant of the new trial, or the grant of the new trial, was conditioned on, among other things, acceptance of a reduced amount of pre-verdict interest.
But it's
why isn't that included in remittitor?
It's included in the $300,000 reduction. We don't get interest on that, but we get interest on the amount, the $260,000 that was left intact. So we're dealing with three issues: reduction of interest, attorney's fees, and punitive damages. That's all I have to talk to today. So do you lose your right to appeal those unrelated issues by accepting the remittitor? The answer is no. Acceptance of the remittitor on one issue does not prevent appeal of issues that are separate and distinct. Here, Judge Carlson.
Counsel, can I ask a question about the attorney fee issue?
Sure.
Can you connect the dots for us to tell us how this action is related to a watershed district rule and not just the zoning ordinance? And specifically, where in the trial record are the watershed district rules referenced directly?
Well, the violation of the Pequot River Watershed District is alleged in page 7 of the complaint, the 2005 complaint. The violation is proved and found by the trial judge in his April 2016 order. That's finding of fact 20 and 22 and conclusions of law 1, 4, and 14. Therefore, we alleged violation of the watershed district. The judge found it in 2016 in his order. Now remember, the trial, the last trial where the damages were the $560,000 of damages were, that occurred 4 years later in 2019. He had already found that there was a violation of the watershed district regulations. And so that was already found. So is it in the 2019 transcript? I don't think so, because we didn't argue it. It already had been found by the court. Now, in the past, so I can address that issue further. In the past, private parties have petitioned for their attorney's fees. There are very few cases in Minnesota on the attorney's fees issue in private, where private parties have petitioned for attorney's fees. The one that's reported, that's cited all the time, is the one that Mr. Lamb's the Allender's client, the Allender's attorney's firm, they're the one who participated in one of those lawsuits and requested attorney's fees. Now, remember, that statute says the court may award, it says in any civil litigation related to a rule under this chapter, the court may award the prevailing party reasonable attorney's fees. So Lamb's firm requested attorney's fees, but they didn't get it because the court found that there was no prevail, that they were not the prevailing party in that action. So if he claims that the statute doesn't permit attorney's fees to be awarded to private citizens, that's not only contrary to the statute, but that's inconsistent with the position that his firm took in the widely reported case in there. So on that issue, the court should reverse the district court, remand for an award of reasonable attorney's fees. If I could return briefly to the interest of prejudgment interest. Here, Judge Carlson stopped prejudgment interest in September of 2015, 3.5 years early, based on equity. The statute doesn't allow the court to consider equitable principles. And that was found by Judge Forsberg, who sat on this court for many, many years, way over 10 years. He said prejudgment interest is not subject to equitable reduction. To quote him, he says, the language of the statute is mandatory and there is no basis in the case law to support a reduction. Now that dealt with a 7-month continuance. In that case, the plaintiff wanted a continuance of the trial, got a 7-month continuance, and the defendant said, well, there shouldn't be interest based on that. It's inequitable. They're the ones that asked for the trial. They're the ones that caused the delay. Forsberg denied that argument and held that the language of the statute is mandatory. Another case, Your Honor, shed lights on this case, and that was Kelly versus Kelios, where the judge was Federal Judge Susan Nelson. And in 2019, here's what she said about prejudgment interest in a clawback case. She was asked to use a different start date for interest. Here's what she said. The court declines to arbitrarily pick a fair start date for the application of prejudgment interest, as that would conflict with the statute's mandatory language. See Minnesota Statute 549.09 Subdivision 1B, stating that prejudgment interest shall be computed from the time of the commencement of the action. That's what Judge Nelson said just a year ago. Now, so
Counsel, I'm sorry. I see you're running a little short on time, and I want to ask you a question about the manner in which you claim that you preserved your objection or your appeal rights on the punitive damages issue.
We made our motion to amend for punitive damages back, I don't remember when, 2016 or 17 or 18, one of the last 5 or 6 years of this litigation, and it was denied. We again raised it pursuant to case law after the trial was over. We again raised that issue, and it was denied.
And what was the mechanism by which you raised that issue?
We made a motion. We made a motion to amend for punitive damages.
Okay. It was just a motion to amend the complaint to conform to the evidence?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, we made the motion before. Now, so here's the deal with punitive damages. It's not the judge's duty to weigh the evidence, to listen to the plaintiff's evidence and then the defendant's evidence and weigh that. It's the plaintiff's duty to present a prima facie case. If you present a prima facie case of deliberate disregard for the rights of the plaintiff, that's under the statute, deliberate disregard. If you present a prima facie case, you get to go to the jury. You get to try that case.
Counsel, I'd like to follow up on the standard for punitive damages. In Minnesota, I think there may be one case, but I'm not aware of anything recent that has allowed or approved an amendment for punitive damages where the allegations related to property damage solely. And isn't that what you have here?
It is.
And I don't, as I understood the facts, there is not even a threat to human life. Yes, I appreciate flooding can result in that, but that's not we don't have a safety issue here, do we?
No, we don't, Your Honor.
I'm troubled by that, and it seemed to me that that was the district court's analysis and reason for not allowing the amendment had to do with the type of conduct that we have here. It really is a property dispute between two parties, a very important one, and it's unfortunate it lasted as long as it did. But I don't see where that entitles your client to an amendment to add punitive damages. So if you'd help me understand that.
The statute, sub three of the statute talks about the awareness, attitude, and conduct of the defendants. The buildable lot, there are three factors which become egregious. The buildable lot conversation where the contractor, where the defendants contacted one contractor who said the lot's too, it's lot's not buildable, it's too low. The second contractor that they said, said, we'll wait till the Lakers go home. That's people who have cottages. In the fall, we'll scrape the cabin, raise the lot, build the cabin in the winter. And when they come back in the spring, it'll be all built and they won't be able to do anything about it. The second one was the Weber Grill incident where they were talking one night about their proposal and the to build. And the plaintiff said, and the defendant said, we plan to bring in fill up to a Weber Grill, to which Roaches responded, you better follow all the law regarding permits because I don't agree with that. The third one was when they asked Roaches to consent to a variance and Roaches refused. The fourth thing is when they asked—
Counsel, if I can just stop you briefly. I mean, you have covered this in your brief. It seems to me you're describing a series pieces of evidence that, in your opinion, and it may be a jury would agree with you, that the parties here deliberately violated, you know, certain laws. That's not the same as showing the basis for punitive damages, is it?
No. What you have to prove under sub three are that the seriousness of the act or the acts of the defendants. And the statute is not limited to punitive to a personal injury. It covers everything, including property damages. The serious is a continuing flooding situation that's lasted for 15 years. And the one of the questions on the jury verdict was, if you award damages, will that remedy the problem? And the answer was no. So it's a serious problem.
All right.
The awareness, attitude, and conduct I've discussed. The awareness.
All right, counsel, I think you've answered the question and are now have extended beyond your time. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal to follow up on this or any other topics. With that, we'll turn to counsel for respondents. I'm not sure the order in which you're going to argue, but you will let me know. Make sure you take your mute off if you are talking.
Hey, please, the court. Counsel, my name is Steve Lamb, and I'm here on behalf of Sandra and Thomas Allender. And as counsel indicated, this case has gone up and down and had several different trials and for 15 years. And I got into this business 30-some years ago to resolve problems for people. And that's what my understanding of the court system was, is for resolution. And we're here to resolve disputes. That's why we have deadlines, that's why we have rulings, that's why we have jury trials, and frankly that's why we have a new trial and a remittitor process, and that is to resolve cases, to come to an end. Now, things don't always get right for everybody. In fact, that's usually the end of the matter is not everybody's happy in the end, but it's resolved. People move on, get on to other things. And that's what this case needs. And that's what Judge Carlson, and one of the things in this case is, you know, as I read my brief and I read everybody's brief and then I read the order many, many times, the order is superior, far superior to my brief. The order from Judge Carlson spells everything out very well. It spells out, dictates, and well-written, well-analyzed. So supported by case law, why, what's supported, you know, the law and all the issues that Mr. Grand wants to raise. And then Judge Carlson, in his opportunity to resolve this case, which is what this needs to be done after 15 some years and several appeals, gave the opportunity to, have a remitter in this case. And granted, and counsel for plaintiff for the Roaches accepted the remitter without protest even.
And, well, but counsel, it seems to me that when we look at the question of remitter, we have to look at what the motion for the new trial was, and, you know, the condition under which that new trial was going to be granted. And I don't see anything in the district court's remitter order that suggests that the issue of attorney fees or punitive damages or even the legal issues about pre-verdict interest would be included in the remitter. Why am I wrong?
Well, the remitter is a precedent for the judgment, and they accepted the remitter, and so the remitter becomes part of the judgment. It becomes all in one. And I think, as the court indicated to in its questions to the other counsel, you know, how is it that these other issues are different than the remitter? Well, the remitter is acceptance of the whole judgment. The remitter is the precedent for the judgment, which they appealed from. And so that encompasses everything. And the remitter encompasses, our argument is it encompasses the whole,
I thought that the post-trial motion that the respondents brought was premised on lack of evidence supporting the award of future damages. Were there other arguments in the post-trial motion that I'm not aware of?
That was our argument for the new trial, yes.
All right. And that's, so why would the remitter, I mean, it seems to me that the remitter then focused on the jury's award, and specifically with respect to that item of damage, why would the remitter affect a separate motion for attorney fees or punitive damages?
Because the remitter becomes inclusive of everything in the case. The remitter is essentially counsel's agreement to end the case, to resolve the case in whole, all the issues in the case, to end the case or have a new trial on all the issues in the case.
What is the authority under Minnesota law that the acceptance of a remitter operates as a waiver to all of the appeal rights of a party?
Well, I think in the Jangala Konek case basically set that out, and as the common law rule, in that case there was an exception because there was a cross appeal, but in that case it set out the common law rule that was spelled out since by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1822.
But in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated that it did not need to weigh in on whether to adopt that common law rule.
Well, it stated the common law rule that it was working on, and it adopted the case out of Wisconsin, which essentially had the Donovan or the Konigsberger rule that the plaintiff cannot appeal the propriety of a remitter, to which he has agreed, and the whole point, the purpose of it is for judicial economy, for social economy, to resolve, as I started this argument, is to resolve the matter, to end the matter, and not go into, or part of my argument was you can't start piecemealing this whole process, get one issue separate from the other issue, or this case is never going to end. This case will be appealed for eternity. In fact, we deposited and Heitkamp's deposited, the court allowed us to deposit our money. We deposited that, And that was appealed. I mean, this case needs to be resolved, and our position is that the remitter is the acceptance, and once they accept it, they accept all the rulings in the case, the pretrial motions, all the rulings, and all the post-trial rulings. They accepted it. It was a precondition for the judgment. The judgment included all of those rulings, and by withdrawing or attempting to withdraw their agreement for the remitter, which was a total amount, which included interest, which included the ruling on attorney's fees and everything. And with that, the appellate essentially waived their argument on these issues, on all the issues. They've accepted the ruling from the district court on the total amount, and it shouldn't be piecemealed. Otherwise, this court's going to open the door to all sorts of, if anything gets remitted, or to all sorts of ongoing appeals, especially in this case. And I see that my time is up, and I would give Mr. Morley an attempt. And our request is that this appeal be dismissed and denied, and the deposit amounts be deemed satisfaction of the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Morley.
Yes. Oh, can you hear me? I was having trouble with the mute.
Yes.
Okay,
they can see you too.
Thank you. Can you see me okay?
We can.
All right, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Michael Morley. I practice in Grand Forks. I'm coming to you out of my dining room because of the pandemic. I represent defendants Gary Heitkamp Construction, Inc. and Gary Heitkamp individually. And the large issue that I'm hearing the most discussion of today is the remitter issue, the acceptance, the waiver. And that is a very, very large issue. And if I can just dovetail a little bit on what Mr. Lamb got done saying, and in response to a question from the court, the court's order on post-trial motions and conditionally granting a new trial and ordering the remitter was dated August 20 of 2019. That encapsulated, that included all of these issues that the plaintiffs are attempting to argue and have the court rule on appeal. It involved the court's ruling on attorney's fees, punitive damages, pre-verdict interest, Becker County, who we haven't even talked about yet. But the order included and encapsulated every single one of those issues in the order. And in the plaintiff's acceptance of remitter dated October 15 of 2019, the plaintiff accepted carte blanche in its entirety that remitter order. And by stating in the last couple of lines, the plaintiffs hereby accept the district court's remitter pursuant to the court's order on post-trial motions and conditionally granting a new trial. That order include attorney's fees, punitive damages, Becker County, pre-verdict interest. So as Mr. Lamb stated, and I completely agree, the plaintiff's acceptance of that remitter, that lower judgment, included all of these issues that the plaintiff is now trying to have this court to resolve again.
So I'd like to ask you a question about that. The post-trial motion giving the conditional remitter offer or order from the district court, did that include the contempt, civil contempt issue that's in front of us?
Your Honor, no. In fact, the civil contempt issue was only addressed to the Allenders and not to my client.
Oh, but
that was a separate
separate issue for sure.
Yes.
All
yes.
Right. And thank you.
I can't speak to that. I don't want to speak to that because I'm not involved. With all due respect,
I ask that point because your way of reasoning through the scope of the forfeiture by remitter suggests that we simply look at the post trial motion, and I'm just not sure that's right. It certainly would still leave us with a civil contempt issue.
Right.
So I'm not persuaded, but if you want to give it a shot, go right ahead.
And I, with all due respect, I will not speak to that, to the merits, because again, that motion for contempt did not address, it was not directed against my client, Mr. Heitkamp, or his construction company.
I have a similar question, or I guess maybe a related question, and that is the issue of reallocation of the fault attributed to Becker County. Is that also something that would be outside of the parameters of the remitter order?
That was included in the remitter order as well, Your Honor, because that was the judgment for motion. I'm sorry, motion for judgment as a matter of law, the JMOL, and that was a post-trial motion brought by the Roaches, and the Becker County matter, whether it was proper to place them on the verdict form or not, the percentage allocation, that was also included in the district court's order post-trial and conditionally granting a new trial, because that was addressed at part five, page two of the court's October 20, 2019 order, where the district court specifically said, plaintiff's motion for judgment as a matter of law is denied. That was the motion directed to Becker County, whether they should have been on the verdict form, whether they should properly have been allocated 20% fault or not. So again,
Do you agree at this point there is no common liability between Becker County and the respondents?
Do I agree? I would agree
Becker County was immune, and that issue is not up before us, I guess, according to your argument. So would there be any common liability between the county and the respondents?
There should not be. There should not be. They, even though they're immune, they can still be assessed a percentage that can be offset from this verdict that we are not responsible for. In fact, the plaintiff cites I think it's the Condo versus Honeywell case that says the jury should consider all parties potentially at fault, whether they're parties or to the litigation or not, whether they're exempt from liability because of release, et cetera.
All right. But because the county, by virtue of immunity, was never subject to a common law claim, doesn't that differentiate this situation from the one you're just discussing, where a party has settled out, for example, of a lawsuit?
Well, and quite frankly, Your Honor, we looked at Minnesota law on this subject, and the immunity issue, whether Becker County should be on the verdict form and have a percentage placed upon them, that was brought up during trial, and the plaintiff's counsel agreed with us during trial that that would not prevent a determination and potential decision against Becker County because of immunity. We found cases on workers' comp law in Minnesota. That's an immunity. I don't believe that's common law. That's statutory. So there really was no difference. The plaintiffs changed their position that now Becker County should not have been there because the evidence did not support a finding of fault and a percentage on that, which we believe under the evidence was completely wrong. They were in here. In fact, they should have been in here for more than 20%, Your Honor.
All right.
And I'm looking at my clock. It's flashing red. So I'm sorry to go over. If the court has any questions, be happy to answer them. Otherwise, we'll rely upon our briefs and request that the district court be in all things affirmed. Thank you very much.
Any additional questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morley. Counsel for appellants, you will have the last word, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Lamb made a statement, remitter resolves all issues involved in a trial. That's not true. Minnesota law is absolutely different than that. Remitter does not resolve all issues. Remitter does not resolve issues that weren't raised in the trial. We didn't waive interest, Your Honor. If you look at paragraph 6 of the order, it says defendant's motion for a new trial is granted, conditionally granted, unless plaintiffs accept a remitter of future damages, That's reducing 300 to zero. And costs and disbursements reduced from 93 to 74. That's it. The inclusion, that there was pre-verdict interest is in there, but it wasn't reduced. It wasn't remitted. That issue was never raised and can be raised on appeal. The only thing that we can't appeal on is the remitter of future damages from 300 to zero and cost and disbursements from 93 to 74. Everything else that wasn't raised, we can appeal. And that's punitive damages, interest, and attorney's fees. So the claim that remitter resolves everything, that may be the law in federal court. And in fact, it is the law in Minnesota in federal court. It's not the law in Minnesota, Wisconsin, California, and many others. With regard to inclusion of the county in the verdict, it's sort of a de minimis argument because the defendants are liable joint and several for all damages. So it doesn't matter if the county has no liability because Alan, the builder and the owner, they're liable for all the damages joint and severally, not just 80% of those. But that's
are you withdrawing that argument, counsel?
No, my argument stands that, and here's the deal with that. County and the defendants, the respondents, were united in their defense against the Roach's claims. So there was no evidence presented at trial by the respondents that would keep them in there, because I mean they were essentially out of it. So no, we keep that same argument, but anyway, they're joint and severally liable for all of it, not for just 80% of it, but that's subject to another motion down the road. So anyway. Here's the claim. On the interest, it's not mandatory. There's this sale of fail-safe. We can get out of jail if maybe it sounds like an equitable argument, but if you look at the record, the argument is find my papers. That argument is rebutted by what the court found. The court found in its ruling before trial that the Roaches did not act in bad faith anywhere bringing any of this, and that they were not guilty of delay. And you can understand how there would be how it would take this long to get up to the Court of Appeals and to get a resolution of all these issues. You start at the Board of Adjustment. That gets appealed to District Court. That gets appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals sends it back to the Court of Adjustment or the Board of Adjustment. You go through the Board of Adjustment. That gets appealed to the District Court. That gets appealed to the Court of Appeals. And then it goes back to either District Court or the Board of Adjustment, and that's heard over again, and then it goes up to the Court of Appeals. So you can understand how there was no delay on the part of the plaintiffs, the Roaches. They pursued this meticulously over 15 years and are entitled to the relief that we sought.
Thank you. Panel members, any additional questions? All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you all for your helpful arguments. The matter has been well presented. We will take the case under advisement now and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you all. I am glad that we're able to accommodate this argument.